Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James with another installment of Christogenos. I may have to be doing this show solo this evening because Bill Fink has had a power failure at his house, and if he does call in, it probably will have to be via his cell phone. So he's probably going to try to, since he has got no internet and cable, the only way he could possibly catch the show, either to listen or to be co-host, is to call in. So hello, Gerald. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another issue of Christogenos, okay? And, of course, Christogenos is a reference to the race, the ethnicity of Yahshua Messiah. And, of course, we true Israelites, the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian people, are the true Israelites of the Bible. The Jews are imposters, and they pretend to be of the seed of Israel, but they are not. In fact, the religion of Judaism was not even invented until the era of Herod, when Herod and when John Hyrcanus made a league with the kingdom of Idumea and joined the Edomites together with the Judahites, thereby violating the law of Deuteronomy 7, where we're not supposed to make any covenants with Canaanites at all, ever. And so because of that violation, the kingdom of Judah was overwhelmed and overcome by these Edomites. They infiltrated into the government, took it over, massacred the Israelite priests, and eventually assassinated Hyrcanus too. And that's how the religion of Judaism, that's how the Edomites and Canaanites of Edom became known as Jews. That's the true history of that era. And folks, this is not in your history books, but it is contained in Josephus and in the Apocrypha and other sources, but these are not commonly discussed. Bill, you're there.
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. So you're calling in on your cell phone? Is that it?
Well, I'm using my other line.
Oh, okay.
I'll pay the phone bill.
All right.
I have no long distance on this line, but they'll charge me for it, I'm sure.
I have
19 minutes left on my computer.
Okay.
And the only light I have is a hurricane lamp.
Oh.
There's no power in upstate New York.
Okay.
I can't see anything. I don't have the internet. My internet connection's gone.
Okay. All right. Okay. So you've got a light so you can see your Bible, though, right?
Oh, yeah. I have my Luke translation, the old paper one in front of me.
Okay. All right. Well, I was just going to go and start with, we ended with Luke 19:28, and let me just proceed to Luke 19:29. And it came to pass when he was come near to Bethphage and Bethany, at the mount called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying, go you into the village opposite you, into which at your entering you shall find a colt tied, whereon yet never man sat. Loose him, and bring him here. And if any man ask you, why do you loose him, thus shall you say to him, because the Lord has need of him. And they that went set their way, and found even as he had said to them, and they found this colt, of course, and as they were loosing the colt, the owners thereof said to them, why you loose you the colt? And I think this is really a funny episode here, because it's like saying, hey, you know, you go into this town and just grab a colt and unleash it and take it with you.
Which he knows is going to be there.
Right, of course. He knows it's going to be there. But the fact that the owners say, oh, okay, Jesus wants it. Fine, go ahead, take it. It's like, oh yeah, all I have to do is name drop it. You know, they assume that these people can't be lying. Therefore, they let them have the colt. Oh, if Jesus has a need for it, go ahead, take it. You know, I'm sure Jesus, he's an honest man. He'll bring it back when he's done, right? Okay.
Well, I want to go to the first car dealership in town and tell him I need that big GMC yeah. pickup truck.
Right, right. Yeah, take it. Here's the keys. No charge, right?
Yeah.
And they said, the Lord has need of him. And they brought him to Jesus, and they cast their garments upon the colt, and they set Jesus thereon. Okay, I have to turn the page here. And as he went, they spread their clothes in the way. Okay, so basically he was, they rolled out the red carpet. And when he was come near, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen. Of course, the miracles and whatnot. Verse 38, saying, blessed be the King that comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. So there's a tremendous celebration going on here. Verse 39, And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said to him, Master, rebuke your disciples. Now, Bill, why would the Pharisees tell Jesus to rebuke his disciples?
Well, basically, they were ashamed of what he was saying, of what they were saying, evidently.
Yeah, he was getting all the praise and glory.
Absolutely, yes, but they're ashamed of that. They're actually ashamed of the truth and of God.
Right.
They put on a pious face, but...
Yeah, well, but these people are the high priests, right? These Pharisees.
They're a political sect.
Right.
There's probably some priests mixed in with them.
Yes.
But they're basically, you know, we can't always mistake Pharisees and Sadducees for priests.
Okay.
You know, because they could be the civil leaders of the city.
Right.
You know, it's a whole sect, and even though the ministry of Christ was concentrated, you know, had a lot to do with the temple, and the religious authorities were always the ones who were inspecting him and watching him closely.
Yeah.
So most of the Pharisees and Sadducees he comes in contact with, yes, they're priests, but not, they're from all walks of life. It's a political sect, which is also a religious. They had a whole different paradigm of thought in the ancient world than we have today.
Yeah. Fausto in the chat room says, the state of New York forgot to pay their electric bill.
Yeah, well, they probably did. They forgot to pay the Canadians for Niagara Falls or something.
Yeah.
They had a whole different, you know, being a Pharisee or being an Essene, it wasn't only a political allegiance or religious allegiance, it was a way of life.
Right.
And it affected every facet of their lives.
Right.
And the same thing in the secular world with the Greeks, with the Epicureans and the Stoics and the different sects of philosophy. It affected every facet of their life.
Right. Well, these would correspond to political parties, religious groups. Like today, we have the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church. We have the evangelicals. We have the Jews. We have the Democrats and Republicans, etc. All these people participate in making legislation, you know, and making the society what it is. So we have to pretty much consider that. The Pharisees are one of those, more than likely, a political party with a lot of religious, influence and connotations to their party.
Right.
Okay, so verse 40, and he answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out. Okay, so in other words, these people are celebrating because the Messiah is here, folks. Verse 41.
And now let me say something. The idea of rocks crying out testimony seems to have been something of an adage among the Greeks.
Okay.
And it's there are evidence of this in Euripides and Hippolytus.
Okay.
He talks about the hero, you know, he puts these words in the mouth of the hero Theseus. For if I am to be bested by you when you have done this to me, Isthmian Sinis shall no longer attest that I killed him, but say it was an idle boast, and the Scironian rocks near the sea shall deny that I am a scourge to evildoers.
Okay.
And that's just one example from Greek literature.
Right.
You know, stones crying out in testimony is an adage.
Right. So in other words, there's nothing you can do to stop this. Shut up. This is the way it is, so quit complaining.
Well, basically, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And when he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, at least in your day, the things which belong to your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the day shall come upon you that your enemies shall cast a trench about you and compass you round about and keep you in on every side, and shall lay you even with the ground and your children within you, and they shall not leave in you one stone upon another, because you knew not the time of your visitation. Of course, this is the prophecy of the destruction of the temple and great portions of Jerusalem and the casting out of the Jews and various other physical and political events. Any comment on these three verses here?
Well, concerning the coming destruction of Jerusalem, this is first prophesied in Daniel chapter 9, that it would happen, that they would, you know, Messiah would be cut off, and then the people of the prince, who is Messiah the prince,
yes,
will come and destroy the city. Christ knew that. He knew what was in Daniel. He probably, I'm sure he knew it without Daniel.
Yeah.
And the mainstream commentators all screw this up because they don't realize, first, that the Romans are indeed Judah's Zara. They're the ones that are going to destroy the city, and that makes them the blood avengers of Yahshua Christ, who avenged his blood on Hittites. And as Paul says in Romans chapter 16, that was the crushing of the head of Satan.
Yes.
Which, I mean, it did not eliminate the Edomite Jews, of course, but it set them back. I mean, it severely reduced their population.
Right.
And it severely reduced their influence in the empire.
Right, right. Yes, for a long time. As a matter of fact, with all of the Jews being scattered, I'm talking about the real Jews, not the Judahites, throughout the Middle East and back to Babylon and Pergamos, etc., they were pretty much taken aback by these events that happened in Jerusalem and severely cut off. But obviously they went on until, the Bar Kokhba rebellion?
Well, in Jerusalem, yeah. I mean, the Jews in other areas had a lot of influence in Rome after the time of Constantine.
Okay.
However, they did, the Bar Kokhba rebellion was in the third decade of the second century. It was about 120 to 130 AD.
Right.
Within 5 years of that.
Yeah.
And that was another large rebellion. And that was when they were pretty much driven out of Jerusalem.
Yes.
For good.
Yes, for good. Yes. Okay. Yeah, never to return it. It never belonged to the Jews in the first place, so because they stole it from the house of Judah. And they were interlopers from the beginning.
Right, the Edomites occupied Jerusalem for 500 years, basically,
yeah.
or Judea, at least, for 500 years.
Right, right. Well, I don't know if they occupied it. They lived in the vicinity, but from my understanding, their occupation, you could probably say, when John Hyrcanus made the pact with them, I believe that was near the 125 B.C., and if you carry that to 133 A.D., the end of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, then you got, 250 years.
Right, in Jerusalem itself.
In Jerusalem itself, yes. Okay, verse 45. And he went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold therein and them that bought. Now, this is we get more detail in the book of Matthew on this, but they were selling doves, and they were selling goods for sacrifices, weren't they?
Well, the Jews commercialize everything.
Right.
That's what they do.
That's right.
They see all of life as nothing but an economic opportunity.
Yes.
That's the way they see everything.
Yeah. The Luke glosses over this, but we're told in other passages, especially Matthew, that, and probably in John too, that these priests, these had to be Edomites because the Judahites and Benjamites and other Israelites that might have been here weren't in the habit of selling favors in the temple. This was Edomite activity.
Oh, absolutely. And Jerusalem, well first, I said this when we did Luke 13, when we covered Luke 13, Jerusalem was never an entirely good city right from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
It always had, David never drove all the Jebusites out. The Kenite scribes were always there. Ezekiel criticizes Jerusalem and says that thy nativity is of the land of Canaan, thy father was an Amorite, my mother a Hittite.
Yeah.
It was like New York. You know, as soon as the dust came to New Amsterdam, they brought the Jews with them.
Right.
And they were always there.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jerusalem was no different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, they both started out like New York City. Yeah. And of course, Wall Street, it was named Wall Street because that's where the ghetto wall was, the original Jewish ghetto in New Amsterdam. That was Wall Street. Verse 46, saying to them, it is written, my house is the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Okay, so every time that Yahshua confronts these Pharisees, he never has anything nice to say to them. It's just like in the Old Testament. Yahweh never has anything nice to say about Edomites, right?
No,
so,
never.
So there's a parallel here, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yes, 47. And of course, those people who think that Deuteronomy 23:7, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, that's mistranslated. It should be an Elamite or Arabite, is the proper translation of
an Aramaean, yes.
Aramaean, because Clifton Emmaheiser proved that there was a jot or a tittle missing. Scribe must have, you know, neglected to copy it, and that's what changes the translation.
The Hebrew R and the Hebrew D are very, very close and easily confusable, and there are many instances in Scripture where it is, blatantly evident that they've been confused in
right,
the Old Testament.
Right. So that would have been, if that were properly translated, which it isn't, that would be the only instance in the entire Bible where an Edomite is spoken well of.
Right, but it's not. It should say an Aramaean or
right.
an Aramite and
right.
a Romi as compared to an Edomi.
Yes, exactly.
And that is because Aram was a brother of Eber.
Yeah, right.
They were white Shemites also.
That's right. That's right. Okay, very good. Just for a lot of people that aren't aware of that issue. Verse 47, and he taught daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. Okay? So this animosity, folks, it's a blood feud. There's, you know, it's life and death here. They want to kill him. Verse 48, and could not find what they might do, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. So Yahshua was very famous. The people loved him. Wherever he went, the crowds followed him. And so these Pharisees, you know, were bucking the trend. They were bucking the times. His popularity was at its peak, okay? Chapter 20, verse 1. And it came to pass that on one of those days, as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes came upon him with the elders. Now, we have to kind of, you know, put ourselves in that place and at that time, because this would be very strange for some guy from Galilee to come down to Jerusalem and take over the temple in this manner. Okay, or at least the temple grounds. But obviously, being a Judahite and a Benjaminite, he would have a perfect right to enter into the temple grounds. Okay, the only problem I might foresee is that whoever the high priest was, they might object to him entering into the Holy of Holies because he himself was not appointed as high priest. So I would think that the scribes and Pharisees would take great offense at someone, from Galilee doing this.
I think that their offense was taken because it's obvious that he had thousands of followers following
right,
him.
Right.
And they were jealous.
Yes.
And he was teaching, and they would expect a sedition.
Yes.
I mean, if you were in Washington, D.C. today, and maybe not so much in this day and age because all the electronic surveillance and everything that they could monitor you with, but even in Rome at one time, it was illegal. It was against the law for people to gather in somebody's house in private.
Uh-huh.
If they saw, and this is in Livy, and I don't have it at hand, but I can come up with it if I had to. It's in Livy, the historian of Rome, that if men at in the time of the Republic, if men gathered in private in somebody's house,
uh-huh.
a sedition was automatically suspected.
Okay.
It was without a doubt they suspected a sedition.
So they just assumed that if you're gathering in an improper place, it's a sedition.
Right, absolutely. And
yeah.
And you know, today if you stood in Washington and there were constantly thousands of politicians around you listening to you, how would the president feel?
Right.
You know, and how would the whore in charge of Congress feel?
That's right.
You know, they're not listening to me. They have to listen to me.
Right, exactly.
You know, and the same scenario would play out again.
Yes, absolutely.
And we see it here.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
whenever there's large gatherings of people in any religious venue that's not in one of their official churches, there's a problem with that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what they're doing. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's righteous or not. There's a problem with it just because it's not in an officially approved venue, an IRS 501c3 church.
Right, right. Yeah, well, they would take tremendous offense if Ron Paul's convention had, outpolled or, you know, had larger audiences than the Republican convention that was going on in Minneapolis at the same time, you know?
Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, they would because they'd be calling him an upstart and they call it a sedition or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, they'd say, hey, what's going on here? Don't follow that guy. Verse 2, and spoke to him saying, tell us by what authority do you do these things? or who is he that gave you this authority? Okay, yeah, so they're totally objecting to what he's doing here. And he answered and said to them, I will also ask you one thing and answer me. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or of men? And they reasoned with themselves, saying, if we shall say from heaven, he will say, why then believed you him not? Okay, because the, you know, John was a prophet. Verse 6, but and if we say of men, all the people will stone us, for they be persuaded that John was a prophet. And they answered and said, they could not tell from where it was. So if you ask a politician today a tough question, what typically happens?
Absolutely.
They avoid answering the question.
All the time.
Yeah. And Jesus said to them, neither tell I you by what authority I do these things. So there. Verse 9. Then began he to speak to the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard and led it forth to husbandmen and went into a far country for a long time. And at the season he sent a servant to the husbandmen that they should give him the fruit of the vineyard. But the husbandmen beat him and sent him away empty. Wow, these husbandmen are not very nice characters, are they?
Absolutely not.
Okay, let me continue 11 and 12. And again he sent another servant, and they beat him also, and entreated him shamefully, and sent him away empty. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also, and cast him out. Then they said to the Lord of the vineyard, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. It may be that they will reverence him when they see him. Okay? So when Yahweh sends his beloved son, Yahshua, surely they wouldn't kill him too, would they?
Well, they absolutely will.
Yes, they absolutely will. In other words, this is kind of the parable is talking about where Yahshua in previous verses talks about the fact that the Pharisees killed all the prophets.
Yes, and that was Luke chapter 11. And,
right.
And here they kill him. And that shows, first it shows that they're husbandmen.
Right.
They're not the children. They're not the heirs.
Right.
They're husbandmen over the vineyard.
Yes. So would there be any connotation in the Greek? What's the Greek for husbandmen, if you can see with the dim light you've got there? Would there be any connotation of usurpers or overthrowers or anything
no,
like that?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
It's just somebody who's not the owner, who's
right.
like a tenant landlord sort
yes.
of.
Someone who's been hired to oversee or
right.
who's currently overseeing the estate.
Right.
Yes.
There's no, you know, it's, you know, Yahweh in his permissive will handed the kingdom over to Satan.
Right.
I mean, that's and that's what Revelation 17:17 says. So we see that happens. There's no doubt that happens.
Right.
That we because we're being punished, he handed the Satan over to the
right.
I mean, if Adam didn't fall, if Adam didn't transgress, Satan would never be able to hold the kingdom.
Right, right. But the implication here is certainly that the husbandmen, the people in charge, are evil. And people should understand this.
Well,
okay.
Yes, these husbandmen are definitely evil, and are evil right from the beginning.
Right, right. Verse 14, but when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, this is the heir, H-E-I-R, the one to whom the kingdom belongs, folks. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours. So isn't he clearly talking about the Pharisees here?
Absolutely.
That's right.
And they knew it.
Yes.
The gospel says that they knew it.
Right. And so, and why don't the average Christians understand this, that this parable is talking about these evil Pharisees, and it can't be the Romans.
Well, it's because the Pharisees are teaching today.
That's right. The Pharisees approve all the doctrine that comes out of the mainstream Judeo churches. Verse 15, so they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him, that what? Therefore shall the Lord of the vineyard do to them. He shall come and destroy these husbandmen and shall give the vineyard to others. And when they heard this, they said, God forbid. Now, of course, this is a prophecy of the judgment day. That these Pharisees, who are the husbandmen being referred to, will be destroyed at the second coming. Okay? Isn't this clear?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So why are these Judeos always saying that we should try to convert these husbandmen instead of giving them the business that they deserve? Okay.
Christians don't read the Bible, so
that's
they
right.
get away with teaching all sorts of lies.
Yeah, absolutely. All this stuff about God loves everybody, and they can't read the Bible. You can't read the Bible and under, you know, get that message. The Bible simply says nothing of the kind. Verse 17, that he beheld them and said, "What is this then that what is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner." Okay, what does this mean?
Well, this is another, we spoke about this, I don't remember, on one of the programs recently. This is another example that this stone is an allusion to the fact that the Great Pyramid had no capstone.
Right.
And the stone that the builders rejected is not, the builders are not the Edomites. The
right.
builders are not the scribes and the Pharisees.
Right.
The builders that rejected the stone. First, it might be an allusion to the angels who left their first estate.
Could be, yes.
Because that first rebellion was a rejection of Yahweh's creatures from Yahweh.
Okay.
Okay? Now, the children of Israel, I think that this is an allusion to the fact that the Great Pyramid has no capstone.
Right.
And that Great Pyramid is related to our race as its builders.
Right, yes.
The children of Israel rejected Yahweh in the desert. They rejected him when they came into the land of Canaan.
Uh-huh.
They're the builders, and they rejected God.
Right.
For worldly authority and worldly government.
Right. Well, yeah, our ancestors promised that they would obey his commandments, and they decided to rebel, okay? So, yeah, the symbolism of the Great Pyramid and the capstone, obviously Yahshua Messiah is that capstone, that he will become the head of the pyramid, which is the builder race, the people who built the Great Pyramid, Adam, Seth, and Enoch, will
the people who have built everything.
Yeah, that's right.
There's only one builder race on the face of the planet.
That's right.
The other races need not be invited.
That's right.
They're destroying races.
Yes. Well, they're not going to be in the wedding feast of the Lamb. That's for sure. That's going to be Israelites only. Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken. Now, I wonder what John Hagee would have to say when he says that Jews have their own path to salvation. But they're going to have to get past Jesus Christ, aren't they?
Right. And that, you know, that story about the Jews having their own path to salvation, that's got to be 2,000 years old.
Right.
You know, that's got to be, it might even be older than that. It might be as old as Cain. But,
yeah.
But that's besides the point.
Yeah.
Yahshua Christ says, no one gets to the Father except through me.
Right.
Nobody. I mean, he leaves no other he leaves no room for another path.
Right. You must go through Yahshua.
He only came for the sheep.
Yeah.
So to me, that tells me nobody else gets to the Father.
Right, right. Okay, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. Okay, God loves everybody, right? Verse 19, and the chief priests and the scribes the same hour sought to lay hands on him, and they feared the people.
Well, they wanted to kill him because of the hate speech.
That's right.
Basically,
yeah, he was telling
them hate crime.
He was telling them to their faces that they're evil, and that they want to kill him. He knows that they want to kill him, and they do want to kill him. These people aren't Romans, folks. These are Judean Pharisees, Edomites. They sought to lay hands on him, and they feared the people, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them. They perceived correctly, didn't they? And they watched him and sent forth spies, which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, that so they might deliver him to the power and authority of the governor. Of course, we have to include into this scenario the fact that the Romans would not permit the scribes and Pharisees or any other indigenous Judean power the right to execute anybody, okay? That the Romans reserved for themselves. Okay?
Well, that was because Judea had been reduced to a province.
Right.
Under the first Herod, Herod was actually recognized as a subject king. And he would have had the power of life and death over anybody in Judea.
Yes.
But Archelaus, Herod's successor, was such a screw-up that the Romans removed him from the kingship. They made him go live in Spain. So we have Jews in Spain at that time.
Right.
Edomites in Spain. Well, there were probably Edomites in Spain before that. And yeah, they had exiled Archelaus, and then they had split the kingdom into tetrarchies,
right,
and reduced it to a province, which meant that the rulers of the province, they did not have the power of life and death over their subjects.
Yes. Yes.
They had to get the Romans to do their executions.
Right, right. Yeah, a couple of comments in the chat room here. Malachi 1:3, and I hated Esau. God does not love everybody. Gerald writes in, what the Jews have done against civilizations is the all-time crime against humanity, and their crimes against humanity are never ending. They have never, they started with Cain, and they have not ended since. They simply have not changed their ways at all.
Right. The Jews are the authors of hate crimes.
That's
the
right.
The greatest hate crime in the world is to kill God.
Right.
And that's what they did in 32 A.D.
That's right. Okay.
The second greatest hate crime is World War II.
Yeah.
And the Jews are responsible for that.
That's right. And the gulags and the extermination of the white Christian Russia.
Right. That's probably the third greatest hate crime.
Yes. Right. Verse 21. And they asked him, saying, Master, we know that you say and teach rightly, neither accept you the person of any, but teach the way of God truly. Is it lawful? Now, here they were stroking him, weren't they? Okay, because this is the Pharisees speaking, or the people said to
Fame.
Well,
they're trying to trap him, so they're going to stroke him and kiss up to him so
right.
they could trap him. I mean, the government works the same way today.
Exactly. They set people up, yes. So verse 22, is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? So let's bring this up to date. What about today's IRS, okay, which is totally illegal? The 16th Amendment was never passed properly, never voted on properly. Yet they demand taxes. Of course, this is all illegal. Verse 23, but he perceived their craftiness and said to them, why tempt you me? Okay. Show me a penny. Whose image and superscription has it? They answered and said, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things which be Caesar's, and to God the things which be God. So this begs the question. First of all, I want to say that I don't agree with the modern Judeo-Christians who think that we, this statement says we should pay our taxes no matter what, okay? Because this says, render to Caesar those things which are Caesar's. Now, if Caesar has taken power through insurrection illegitimately, they're not really his, are they?
Well, that's true, but, I mean, they print the money.
Right, right.
They print the money. Give them their dollar. Give them their dollar and stay free, and you'll be a lot better off to your brethren
right.
so that you can give the things that are Yahweh's to Yahweh.
Right. But
I mean, you're not helping your community in prison.
Right. It doesn't mean we should accept tyranny. What it means is we should understand there's a difference between, what an illegitimate king demands versus what he's really entitled to.
Well, absolutely. And the government is evil, and the IRS is evil, and there's no doubt about it. But we're told that Yahweh would hand our kingdom over to the beast.
Right.
And that's the time we're living in.
Yeah. And if we want to fight against the beast, the proper way is to come out of Babylon and establish our own kingdom, our
right.
own civilization.
The proper way to fight against the beast is to stop going to the sporting events, going to the movies,
right.
dealing with the devils,
right.
accepting multiculturalism. You
right.
don't have to hire the contractor to bring a Mexican laborer to your house. You better not hire him.
Right.
And there's a whole list of things that can be done to cut off the beast. And all of that hurts the beast because
yeah.
you stop enriching the beast.
Yeah, and the more we involve ourselves in the beast system, the more tax we have to pay, right?
Right. Spending money on the media and lottery tickets.
Right.
All these little things add up.
Right, right. Yeah, and the charges and the interest add up too, yes.
Right. Credit cards,
yes.
engaging in that. Yeah, that's all evil.
Yes, it's all evil. And to the extent that we are participating in that, then we have to render unto Caesar, don't we? Okay, verse 26. And they could not take hold of his words before the people, and they marveled at his answer and held their peace. So he always had the right answer, right? He always outsmarted them. Verse 27.
Well, it's hard to box with God.
That's right. Yes, right. Then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there is any resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Master, Moses wrote to us, if any man's brother die having a wife, and he die without children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed to his brother. Okay? I forget the name of that law. It's not levirate. There's another name for that. Anyway, There were therefore seven brethren, and the first took a wife and died without children, and the second took her as a wife, and he died childless. The third took her, and in like manner seven also, and they left no children and died. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven has had her as a wife. First of all, let me just ask you, do you think the question makes sense? Does it even apply to the resurrection?
It's like this, and Christ shows that it doesn't apply to the resurrection, but it's like this. The Sadducees are very materialistic people. And actually, it can be shown, as we have from Acts chapter 5 last week, that the high priests of this time are Sadducees.
Okay.
They're not Pharisees.
Yes.
The Pharisees are the majority sect.
Yes.
But the high priests at this time are Sadducees.
Okay.
But now, the Sadducees, and I had a quote here from Acts, from I think Acts 26 or Acts 28, but I don't have my computer.
Okay.
But, you know, the Sadducees do not believe in a spirit
right.
or a resurrection.
Right.
Okay, and this is told us by Josephus, and it's told us by the apostles.
Right.
Now, at this time they come short of disbelieving in God himself.
Right, okay.
Who's the Spirit?
Sure.
He's the Lord of spirits all throughout the Old Testament.
Right.
Of course, today's Sadducees have no problem denying God.
Right, yeah, because even the church would say that. Depending on which denomination you go to, they don't believe in God.
No.
Yeah.
And the Sadducees just want to trip him up.
Right.
So they think they've devised this clever argument.
Right. Yeah. So they're being sneaky here, just like the Pharisees were before the Sadducees, since they really don't believe in a resurrection. For them, it's actually a rhetorical question. But they're asking here, well, what do you believe? Okay. Because they want him to confess that he does not believe like they do, and then therefore they can accuse him of blasphemy for denying what they believe. Okay, so let's continue. Verse 34, and Jesus answering said to them, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world in the resurrection we're talking about here, and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage. So what do you think he's saying so far in verses 34 and 35?
Well, it's basically that, and you know, once you're dead and resurrected, you're going to live forever.
Right.
And Paul explains that marriage, you know, and sexual reproduction was given for us, and this was a necessary thing in this world.
Right. Okay.
Because we don't live forever.
Yeah.
However, in the resurrection, we live forever.
Right.
And it's not necessary. It's not. And Christ is saying that we won't be participating in that.
Okay.
I know that's going to let a lot of people down, especially the Muslims that get 70 virgins and can't do anything with them.
Well, whatever it is, right? But it's going to be way better than what we got now, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Verse 36, neither can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels. Now, of course, this can only be a spiritual reference because we don't know of any immortal beings on this plane, right?
No.
So it has to be literal angels, not messengers, as the No Satan crowd like to interpret this word. And are the children of God being the children of the resurrection? Okay, so we will become immortal. That's exactly what we have been anticipating, because when Adam and Eve were formed, they were intended to be immortal. But they lost that immortality when they sinned. And Paul tells us very clearly that we will regain that immortality. We'll put off mortality for immortality. What's the other expression he uses? Corruption for incorruption. Okay? And so we're talking about literal immortality here. Okay?
Now, an interesting point here is that Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost, the great theologian John Milton, he actually has Adam and Eve having conjugal relationship before the fall.
Okay.
But
right,
they ate an apple, too.
Okay, all right, interesting. Verse 37, now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush when he called them the Lord, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, for he is not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. So here he was rebuking the false doctrine that these Sadducees held, that there is no afterlife.
Now let me say something here.
Okay.
Because a lot of people, you know, I know what it says in the wisdom books in Solomon. about being dead and sleeping and not knowing anything.
Right.
And I think that that is from Solomon gained a worldly perspective through all of his Canaanite wives, and I don't think he was right about that.
Could be, yeah.
Because we have a transfiguration on the mountain. We have Enoch and Moses appearing to Peter, and,
right.
and they were Enoch and Moses.
Yeah.
I mean, a Christian shouldn't doubt that. There's no reason to doubt the veracity of that story.
Well, the Bible clearly says that that death is a form of sleep, okay? And while you're in deep sleep and totally unaware of anything, then you obviously don't know anything. But that's just one stage of sleep. There are other stages of sleep.
Well, right.
Are you dreaming?
And Christ says with Abraham that Abraham was longed to see my day, and he saw it and was glad.
Right.
In other words, Abraham's consciousness has to exist and be.
Right.
Exactly. There's a word I'm looking for. I don't have it. But
yeah.
But it has to be active in the time of Christ.
Right. And then obviously Moses and Elijah, when they appeared, you know, to the disciples.
They were conscious.
They were Moses and Elijah. That's
right.
What they were.
And what I'm saying here is that what Christ is saying here is that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are living.
Yes.
They may not be
That's
living
right.
in the physical plane, but they're living.
Yeah. And depending on the state of sleep that you're in, you can either be in REM sleep, which most of the time you're actually dreaming.
Well, I think that sleep is used as a metaphor as a departure from the physical world.
Exactly, exactly. So it's not death. It doesn't mean that your soul gets destroyed. Okay?
Or that your soul becomes not conscious.
Right, right. But the metaphor is that, for example, when we are asleep, we are not conscious of ourselves, but that doesn't mean that we no longer exist because we're not conscious of ourselves. Okay? So the connection that the No Satan people say, when you're dead, you know, your soul is destroyed. Well, that's ridiculous. There's nothing in the Bible that says anything of the kind. Okay? And you know, wouldn't it be crazy? Well, what happened when Lazarus was raised from the dead? Did his consciousness, did his personality disappear? And then his personality was reconstituted when he was raised from the dead? No. His soul never was destroyed. It was always there. It just wasn't connected to that body.
Well, the way I look at that is that if we die and our consciousness disappears,
yeah, from the body.
Then what's the lesson?
Right.
I mean, if it's destroyed, then what's the lesson?
Yeah, right.
What did we learn? We learned nothing.
That's right.
And none of our ancestors believe that.
Of course not.
None of the Old Testament Christians believe that.
That's right.
And I call them Old Testament Christians.
Yes.
None of the other branches of the race. I mean, Achilles is said to have appeared I'm at a loss for words all the time. As an apparition.
Right.
Okay, the ghost of Achilles. Odysseus descends into Hades and visits the souls of the dead.
Right.
And they're all conscious, and he's talking to them. And they all remember their lives
exactly.
on earth.
Yeah, and then when Jesus descended into the underworld to preach a final sermon to the souls in the underworld.
Right, what would be the point?
Right.
If your consciousness ceases to exist when your body dies,
yeah.
there's no point in religion.
That's right.
Just throw all your books in the garbage
yeah,
and go live a hedonistic lifestyle.
Yet there are people, even with identity, who believe that stuff. You know, so it's really weird. It's a really weird doctrine, in my opinion. Okay.
Well, that's because, to me, they're unread. A lot of people in identity believe a lot of things, and to me, I just believe that they go all these different directions because they haven't really read.
Or they bring that type of doctrine with them from their past denomination. You know,
well, right, but they may have read the Bible once when they were Baptists.
Yes.
You know, but they don't. You have to wipe the slate clean and read it again.
Right, there you go. Yeah, bring that excess baggage leads to errant doctrine. Yes, very good. Verse 39, then certain of the scribes answering said, Master, you have well said. Okay, so they're still tempting him, right? They're still stroking him, buttering him up, and hoping that he'll give a bad answer. And after that, they dared not ask him any question at all. So he shut them up really good. So they really couldn't say, you know, they don't even know anything about the afterlife. They just don't believe in it.
Absolutely. And in one of the other Gospels, they return to the high priest, and they get rebuked for not having a charge against him.
Right. Right, exactly.
I don't remember if it's Mark or John, but it's in one of them.
Right, yeah, that's it's alluded to in this chapter 20, but it doesn't mention that fact, yes, that they went back and said, hey, the Pharisees said, well, why did you bring him here? We sent you out to arrest him.
Right, and they said, we never heard anybody talk like that.
Yeah, the people love him. you know, they would have killed us if we tried to do that. Okay, verse 41. And he said to them, how say they that Christ is David's son? And David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit you on my right hand. Now, of course, it's quoting here Psalm 110, verse 1. Let me turn back here real quick.
Right, and it's the Lord said to my master, because the first the first occurrence of it comes from the Hebrew for Yahweh, for the Tetragrammaton, and the second occurrence comes from the Hebrew word Adon.
Yes. Yes, or Adonai. Yeah, the two words are related.
And they were both translated into the Greek kurios in the Septuagint.
Uh-huh.
But when I did my translation here, I wrote, the Lord, Yahweh has said to my master.
Right.
And I took the liberty of making the amendment from the Masoretic text, from the Hebrew text.
Right, yeah, because that's the way it should read.
It's the only way it makes sense.
Right, yeah. Because otherwise you think it's referring to the same entity in both cases, which it is not.
Right.
Or at least it is, it can be referring to the same entity, but one is his name, the other is a title.
And I really believe that this is all symbolic, and actually Yahweh is Yahshua, and that's how he could be the master of David and yet be his son.
Okay. All right. Well, here, let me quote Psalm 110, verse 1 here. Yahweh said to Adonai, sit you at my right hand, until I make your enemies your footstool. So, you know, it's not clear that it's the same person here. Verse 2, Yahweh shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule you in the midst of your enemies. Okay, so let me, verse 3, too, is very good. Your people shall be willing in the day of your power, in the beauties of holiness from the womb of the morning. You have the dew of your youth. So it's referring again to the judgment day. Oh, in verse 4, Yahweh has sworn and will not repent. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Okay, so it's talking about the establishment of the priesthood of Melchizedek, which we Israelites are supposed to be. Every male head of household is supposed to be a king priest of the order of Melchizedek, and Yahshua is the high priest of that order, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why don't the churches teach anything about this? You know, because their Nicolaitan priesthood is not this order of Melchizedek, is it?
Well, you know, the Catholic priesthood, none of the Protestant priesthoods have exceeded it, have transcended the errors of the Catholic priesthood.
That's right.
Some of them broke away from the idol worship. Some of them broke away from some of the rituals or some of the sacraments. They never departed from all the sacraments.
Yes.
And they're the direct descendants, theologically, of the Catholic Church.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Now, the Catholic priesthood, from its inception, was a pagan priesthood.
Right.
When Christianity was legitimized, before that happened, Christian churches had no priests.
Right. They didn't have an order of priests that was distinguished from the male heads of household of the Israelite congregation.
Well, the pagan priests just changed their name.
Right. There you go.
They took the sign off the temple that said Zeus,
right.
And they put up a sign that said Mother Mary or
right.
Sacred Heart.
Yeah, right. They turned the sign around. It had a Christianized version of Semiramis.
Well, that's
you know what? Mary is in that name. Semiramis. It's in there somewhere.
Legalizing Christianity, paganized it.
Right.
It was made the Theodosian, I believe, made it the official religion of Rome.
Okay.
And a pagan priest had no choice.
Right.
But to become a so-called Christian priest.
Yes.
But there are no Christian priests.
Right, they really
are. We have one priest. Every man is in a sense, in Scripture, a priest over his own household.
That's right.
But we have one priest in the Christian religion.
Right.
And that's Yahshua Christ.
And so there's no order of priests intercessing between Yahshua and the king priests of the households.
Absolutely not.
That's right.
And we could talk about, you know, if you want to talk about the models of the Roman priesthood, you know, the word pontiff comes directly from a Greek word pontus and a Latin word pontus, which means a bridge.
Okay.
And the pontiff is the bridge to God.
Right.
In other words, you can't talk to God yourself. And this mentality is still in the Catholic Church.
Right.
And the Pontifex Maximus is the chief bridge to God.
Right.
In other words, you have to go through him. That's the arrogance of the title.
Right, right. He's the counterfeit replacement for Yahshua Messiah.
Now, if you look at the College of Cardinals they established, that's the reincarnation of the Roman Senate.
Okay. Right.
And the word cleric comes from a Greek word. It doesn't come from clerk, like they claim. It comes from a Greek word, klerukos.
Okay.
Which means an allotment holder for the mother city. Okay? If you were
an
Athenian and you received a colony, just the same way the late medieval English did it in the 1700s, 1600s, if you were an Athenian and you received a grant of a colony overseas by the city of Athens, you were called the klerukos, or the allotment holder
for
the mother city. And all of these priests, clerics of the Catholic Church, the mentality is that the Pope owns the world.
And you, the allotment holder, have a franchise.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the mentality of the Catholic Church.
Right.
That's the arrogance built into the language that's for the most part concealed from the people because they don't understand the language.
That's right. It's not scriptural language, is it?
No, it's governmental language.
That's
it's
right.
Worldly beast government language.
Well, doesn't the Pope call himself the, what's the terminology, the substitute, it means substitute.
Right, vicarious.
Vicarious, yes, vicariate, right.
And that means vicar or substitute
vicar,
for the Son of God.
Vicar, yeah, substitute.
And that word... that phrase, vicarius filii Dei, when you add up the values of the Roman numerals in the Latin language, the total is 666.
That's right. So it's the number 666 is clearly pointing to historical papacy. There's no doubt about it. Yeah, and it's a false priesthood. That's what we in identity are trying to get across.
It's been false from the very beginning.
Right.
It was never, ever a legitimate priesthood because
there
are no legitimate priests. In Christianity.
In the churchianity, yeah. True Christianity, the only priests are Yahshua and the male head of the household, the king priests.
Exactly.
Yes. Very good. And so, I think what we're teaching here, Bill, is extremely radical because, 99% of the Christians in the world today, simply do accept their established priesthood as being legitimate, but they are not.
The only time the word priest appears in the Bible, in the New Testament, is in reference to the Levitical and the Sadducee Pharisee priests in Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
And that was done away with. The rituals were done away with. The temple was destroyed. Okay?
Yeah.
There are no Christian priests mentioned anywhere except where Paul refers to Yahshua and the Melchizedek priesthood in the book of Hebrews.
Right.
Period.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's no legitimate Christian priest. There's no priest word or any word that can be interpreted priest, anywhere else in Paul's epistles in relationship to the community governance of the diakonoi, or ministers, and they're the people who do services for the community.
Yes.
That's what that means. They're servants. The word diakonos is basically a servant. And the episcopus, which actually is the source of the English word bishop.
Okay.
It's kind of roundabout.
Right.
Okay. It went from episcopus, E-P-I-S-K-O-P-S.
Right. Episcopal,
to
episcopus
in Latin, E-B-I-C-O-P-U-S. And then that became bishop in Old English.
Okay.
But it's all the same word.
Right.
Believe it or not, the word bishop came right from the Greek. And it means basically an overseer or a supervisor.
Right.
However, in the Christian community, and it's evident in the book of Acts and it's evident in Paul's letters, the supervisor of the community was elected by the people and answered to the people of the community.
Right. Not to the clerical priesthood or to the papacy. Right.
Right. And it wasn't his job to issue sacraments and papal bulls.
Right.
It was his job to oversee the diakonoi, or the servants.
Yes.
The people who were a point at a service in the community.
Right.
Which could be anything. It could be trash collection.
Right. Right. Accept the needs of the community. Oversaw the needs of the community.
Right. And and a diaconus or a servant, I mean, some of them were appointed for teaching from the scripture or because they were particularly gifted. But basically, a lot of them were, they might be involved in food distribution, as we see in Acts chapter 7. You know, that there could be a lot of things that they could be involved with. Anything that the community felt it needed somebody to manage, a diaconus would be appointed by the community to that purpose.
Right. So the true service of the bishopric, or you know, the true servants of the community, are the heads of household who represent the families in the community, okay, and not some clerical priesthood that's been established by some order of priests that is divorced from the community.
Exactly.
Yes.
And in the Christian community, there's no real recognition and no need for so-called civil government.
Right. Okay, yes.
Okay, the ministers of the Christian community saw to the needs of the community.
Right.
You didn't rely on the emperor or the head of the province or the local government or whatever. You just... They weren't Christian,
right,
and you didn't expect any righteousness from them, and you had no reliance on them.
Right.
Your
right.
community, your little Christian community, was self-reliant, just like the Amish. They're the perfect model. I mean, they're not perfect in all their doctrines,
right,
but they are the perfect model for Christian community in the world today. They come closer to it than anybody's ever come.
Right, right, yeah. They select their own bishops from amongst themselves. And their business is to serve their own community.
Absolutely.
Right.
And
right.
and they're apart from the government, and they don't ask the government for anything.
Right. And they don't want the government to interfere in their affairs.
As soon as you start asking the government for something, the government becomes your god.
That's right.
And the government has a right to butt into every facet of your life.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so let me continue here. Let me repeat this entire reference because it is quoting some of the other verses I read from Psalms 110. And David himself says in the book of Psalms, Yahweh said to my Lord, sit you on my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. And that day is coming, folks. David therefore calls him Lord. How is he then his son? So what are they asking here?
Well, Christ is asking them, why there's a paradox.
Right.
How could this paradox be?
Yes.
Okay, because the Hebrew culture and is so patrilineal.
Yeah.
A son could never be above a father.
Right. Right. Okay.
And that's the challenge. He's asking them to explain the paradox.
Okay. So then in the audience of all the peoples, he said to his disciples, beware of the scribes, which desire to walk in long robes. Catholic bishops, maybe? And love greetings in the markets, Pharisees, and the highest seats in the synagogues, and the chief rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a show make long prayers, that they shall receive greater damnation.
You were raised a Catholic. You know how it was in the community when the priest walked through with his robe.
Oh, yeah.
When he went anywhere, how everybody was sucking right up to him.
Right.
And greeting him and treating
yes.
him so well. And he was all happy and smiles.
Exactly. It was for a great show. It's
all
a great show. Yes, yes. But here, let me. I thought that these three verses here were continue the thought raised in verses 42 through 44. David, verse 44 here, David therefore calls him Lord. How is he then his son? Well, of course, there's a spiritual reality here that's being referred to. Okay. So David, even though he was king, he still has a Lord over him. Right?
Isn't well, that absolutely.
All?
Right.
Yeah. That's all. Now, these scribes that could understand this? I guess maybe they're such good bookkeepers, they never thought about spiritual things. Okay. All right, so chapter 21. And he looked up and saw the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw also a certain poor widow casting in their two mites. And he said, Of a truth, I say to you, that this poor widow has cast in more than they all, for all these have of their abundance cast into the offerings of God. But she of her penury, which is lack, really, has cast in all the living thing that she had. All right, so she's giving of herself way more, percentage-wise, than these scribes, Pharisees, etc.
Right, that word for penury I translate want.
What?
Or want or need.
Okay. All right.
Well, she is. She's, you know, an old woman on a meager pittance of an income she must have had.
Yes.
You know, two pennies would be a hell of a lot of money.
Right.
It's everything she had in the world.
Yeah. So.
And these people that are throwing $100 bills in, well, they've got 10 zillion more of them back there in their treasury.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So they make a great show. But percentage-wise, it's very little. They're really giving very little of themselves. Okay. Verse 5, and as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these things which you behold, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And you want to comment on this? Because this one obviously is a prophecy that became fulfilled.
Right, and that Wailing Wall isn't Herod's wall either.
Right.
That Wailing Wall is obviously it's probably a Muslim construction.
Oh, okay.
From the 600s, 700s. And I've even read that in archaeology magazines.
Right, yeah. It certainly wasn't Solomon's wall. It was built later.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah, yeah. And so they just pretend it is. Or the Second Temple, you know.
Yeah, right. I think they believe it's a wall from Herod's temple, but it's not. It's actually... Many archaeologists have concluded that it's a wall from a Muslim structure built in the early years of the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Maybe
all right.
The 6th or 7th, 8th century, around there.
Okay. Because, yeah, the Second Temple was literally taken apart stone by stone. Verse 7, and they asked him, saying, Master, but when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? And he said, take heed that you be not deceived. Okay, now here's this big, really big, I mean, we're constantly being warned to watch out for deceivers.
Right. First, I'd like to say that, you know, from the other Gospels, and not that any Gospel is wrong,
uh-huh.
They just read, none of them ever recorded every single word he said.
Right.
But actually, from the other Gospels, it can surely be concluded that three questions were asked here and not two.
Okay.
When shall these things be,
uh-huh.
and what are the signs that these things are going to come, and what is the sign of thy coming,
right?
Or when are you going to return?
Right.
It is the third question.
Yeah, that's Matthew chapter 24.
Right, and it's also evident from Mark.
Okay. Yes, okay, so let's see what his answer is here. Take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ. Now, how do we understand this word, I am Christ here? Does this mean I am a Christian or a representative?
Well, no, it's I am the Anointed One.
The Anointed One.
You know, other people would claim to be the Anointed One.
Okay.
It's I am Christ is how, it, you know, it's pretty
right.
plain.
Yeah.
That other people would say, you know, that, and this actually happened 100 years later.
Okay.
With that Apollonius of Tyana or whatever his name is.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, and a lot of people said that he was the Christ, that
yeah.
he was the one.
Yeah, Benny Hinn.
Yeah, Benny Hinn.
who's the Korean guy?
Obama, Barack Obama.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the Korean, Young Sun Moon, I have
yeah.
somewhere in my notes that he anointed himself about 5 years ago the Savior of the world, the third Messiah. Don't ask me how he gets three.
Yeah.
The Savior of the world.
Okay.
And he had a ceremony in Washington. And he, you know, he owns the Washington Times.
Okay.
And a lot of conservatives look googly-eyed at the Washington Times.
Right.
Because it's another Zionist
Reverend Moon,
conservative
yes.
paper. And Reverend Moon owns it. If I have, I can't call him Reverend Mooney. Oh, I can't
right.
call him Reverend.
Exactly.
This young man,
Ludi Moody.
Young Moon owns this paper and has a lot of influence in conservative circles because of that.
Right.
And well, they're all phony conservatives anyway. However, he actually tried to trick a few congressmen or something into signing on to this with him. And this self-anointing that he held.
Right. Well, I know he held one massive marriage ceremony, which was multiracial.
Everything. It's just sick. I mean, yeah. I remember from the 80s. These kids outside the Holland Tunnel selling roses, and they were Moonies.
Right.
And they'd sell these long-stem roses for a couple of bucks, hustling money.
Right.
And they were, you know, they were all multiracial, and these young white girls, pretty white girls in this crowd of whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it used to turn my stomach then.
Yes. Yes. Unrelated question here from the chat room. When are you going to do a show about Hitler?
Sunday night, 9 p.m.
Oh,
Sword Brethren's program.
Okay, this
we're going to talk about Adolf Hitler and Christianity.
Oh, okay. All right, so that answers Omar's question this Sunday. And then he has two shows on Sunday or just one?
Well, I have the 9 p.m. show.
Okay.
I'm going to try to talk Sword Brethren into possibly doing a series of shows on Hitler because I actually have 28 pages of notes.
Oh, okay. All right.
And that's not going to fit into a show.
Okay, so that'll be Sunday on Sword Brethren at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Okay, so let's continue here. Let me just go back to verse 8. Take heed that you be not deceived. And it just really annoys me that the majority of the Christian denominations do not, apparently they do not feel that this warning about deception applies to today. Okay, because they never talk about it, and they should be warning the flock that deceivers will be coming in, taking over.
Absolutely.
But they say absolutely nothing about this in any of their sermons. Nothing. Okay? And so you mentioned a guy by the name of Apollonius, but I would say that the vast majority of priests today, so-called, are phonies.
Well,
deceivers.
Right, but I'm just using him as the first example.
Right.
And, you know, the first historically recorded example.
Yes.
I mean, other people might want to, you know, there was that that fraud that tried to buy his way in. Well, he's in the book of Acts.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I lost his name.
Right, yeah, I know
Simon,
who you mean.
Simon the Magician.
Simon Magus, right.
Simon the Magician.
Yes.
Magician, that means.
Yes.
Others might point to him but he really wasn't a self-proclaimed Messiah.
Okay.
And Apollonius of Tyana, you know, they actually thought he was a Messiah.
Ah.
And he was phony from the ground up.
Right, right. Okay, so verse 9. But when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Okay, so we've had lots of wars and rumors of wars. Certainly in these latter days, the last couple hundred years, but nothing but global violence.
We've been in a state of war since, I mean, we had World War One, World War Two. We had the war on poverty, the war on drugs, war in Korea, Iraq.
Vietnam.
We have men in 170 different countries spread across the globe.
Yeah.
It's nuts. Korea, Vietnam, it's the Cold War. We've been in a constant state of war now.
Right.
Since 1941.
That's right. Well, since 1913, really. I mean, the peace between World War One and World War Two, you know, that's when the Soviet regime.
It was spent
regime,
in depression. It was spent in an economic war on our people.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And so there really never has been much peace in the 20th century, and now either. Right. Okay. Verse 10. Then said he to them, "Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." And that's, of course, the 20th century, and you know, even in the 1800s, with the starting with the Napoleonic Wars, that's when we had actually 1789, something like that, the French Revolution. You could probably go back that far and talk about international warfare. Okay, that's when all this started. And that's when the House of Rothschild was let out of the abyss. And now we're seeing the little season since 1815 of the House of Rothschild causing nations to be at war with one another. That's what the Rothschilds do. That's their favorite business.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
War is the Jews' harvest.
That's right. And so we see kingdom against kingdom, verse 11, and great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, and famines and pestilences, and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. I was just reading today that the increase in the number of earthquakes, you know, since 1910, there was like maybe five to, in a decade, from 1910 to 1920, 5 to 10 major earthquakes, right? The decade leading up to the year 2000, there were 150, okay? And it's been increasing every decade since, okay? So we're definitely getting experience an increase in the number of earthquakes, large earthquakes worldwide. Verse 12, but before all these, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, deliver you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Well, this has been going on for 2,000 years, hasn't it?
Well, right, but this also pits, you know, kinsmen and brethren against each other.
Right.
And that happened, that last happened in history from the time of Christ until the legalization of Christianity.
Right.
And it went on for 250 years.
Yes.
And I think it's probably dividing families again now, but in a different way.
Right, right. Yeah, splitting up denominationally. Verse 13, and it shall turn to you for a testimony. What does this mean here? It shall turn to you.
It shall result in a testimony for you.
Okay.
In other words, he said this would happen, and it did.
Yes.
And that's right there. I mean, he'd really be making a jerk out of himself if he said this would happen, and it never did.
Right. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
This is one reason why Christianity is the true religion.
Uh-huh.
Christ said these things would happen. It's very evident. And they went on for 250 years.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, verse 14. Settle it therefore in your hearts not to meditate before what you shall answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. So when we are called in front of these Edomite councils, and they're still with us today, folks. The Edomites are still with us today. Don't worry about what you shall say. You will be given words
Well, the Romans gave everybody that they killed a chance to make a defense for themselves.
Okay.
And what they would do is, quite often, is they would challenge them to either sacrifice to the god,
the
pagan altar, or face death. They would give them a test, a temptation like that.
Right.
And most of them, I mean, many, many people faced death.
Right.
And they went and died.
Right.
And that is, you know, a lot of people might think that's horrible, but they didn't think it was horrible. They thought it was wonderful.
Right. Yeah, they'd be going to heaven and away from this evil world.
Right. And they rejoiced at that.
Right.
And they were, I mean, that's the idea behind what a martyr is.
Right. Exactly. All right, verse 16, and you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolks and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death, as you were just saying. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Okay? And, of course, this was how Christianity started, where the followers of Christ were hated by everybody outside of Christianity. And it's true of us in identity, too, because they hate us for what we teach. And, you know, there's really no other denomination in the world today that is hated more than we are. So we're kind of reestablishing the spirit that the early martyrs had.
It's the spirit of truth.
That's right.
And the world hates the truth.
That's right.
The Jews especially.
Yeah, exactly. Verse 18, but there shall not a hair of you, of your head, perish. Okay, so obviously we're talking here spiritually that... you know, the true Israelites who have died as martyrs, who have been persecuted, et cetera, will earn eternal life. Verse 19, in your patience possess you your souls.
In your endurance you must gain your life.
Okay, in your endurance you must gain your life?
Yeah, your life. In your endurance must you gain your lives.
Okay.
And they were challenged to hold out to the end, and they would gain their lives.
Right, right. Very good. In other words, yeah, they have to have that faith that you know, that's worth dying for. And of course, the modern Christian churches don't teach anything of the kind. They say, well, if you so much as make the opposition feel bad, you know, because they contradict you, and you have even no right to scold them.
Right, you have no right to offend anybody in the modern paradigm, religious paradigm. It's crazy.
That's certainly not what these verses are telling us. Verse 20, And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is near. Now, of course, we're talking, you know, literally, he's literally talking about the city of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is also a metaphor for true Israel, the Israel people. Aren't we today in a situation where we are totally surrounded by our enemies?
Right, on both coasts.
And, that's right.
And across, you know, Michigan and...
They're everywhere.
We have in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Vancouver overrun by... By aliens, by Orientals, and we have Negroes and Latinos up and down both coasts and along the south. Yeah, we're encompassed by armies again.
Yeah,
we're
totally surrounded and infiltrated by our enemies. Verse 21, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereto. Okay?
Right, and I'd like to talk about this at length.
Yes.
Because first, you know, one may wonder here, how anyone can flee a city which is encompassed with armies.
Right.
Yet comparing this prophecy, as recorded by Luke, to the history of Jerusalem, later recorded by Josephus, we see the events unfold exactly as they are foretold here.
Yes.
Okay, and Matthew and Mark are not in error on this by any means. They just did not record this the way Luke did.
Okay.
You know, they recorded the rest of the discourse or other parts of the discourse or
right.
most of it, but each apostle recorded things as he remembered it, and none of them remembered every statement that was made.
Right. And they don't contradict each other. They just provide different details.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. They don't contradict each other at all. They provide different details.
Yeah. Okay.
And Josephus in Wars, Book 2, Chapter 19, I'm reading this from my notes, some years before the final siege of Jerusalem by Titus, he explains that the city was besieged by a Roman general named Cestius, who was extremely close to taking the city, and for some unknown reason, or at least it was unknown to anybody in Judea, you know, to any of the Judeans, he stopped short of taking the city and withdrew and headed off to Damascus for what's no apparent reason.
Uh-huh.
So here we have the city encompassed by armies, and then the armies are suddenly gone.
Uh-huh.
So this gives the opportunity for the population, those who have the warning of Christ, to flee the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Josephus says after the first siege, Josephus explains that the city is populated with wicked people.
Yes.
But the better citizens, and I'm quoting, swam away from the city as from a ship when it was going to sink.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and there was a major destination point. I forget the name of the town.
Well, the major destination point it isn't provided by Josephus.
Oh, okay.
The name of the town is Pella.
Pella, right.
And it's provided by Eusebius,
okay,
the bishop of Caesarea, who wrote the history of the church around the time of Constantine. Around 330 A.D.
Uh-huh.
So it's 300 years later, but Eusebius is considered, you know, an honest
right.
and good source
yeah.
for this history. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
He wrote a he was from Caesarea in Palestine. So you know he was there
yes.
just a couple hundred years later.
Right.
And he wrote
Very
a history
good.
Of the church from that perspective.
Right. Right. So we could see with this opportunity to flee from Jerusalem, the Judean Christians, which would have been almost to a man, Judahites, Benjaminites, and possibly other Israelites, but we would not expect Edomites to be among their number.
Well, it seems to me that the Christians would have had the warning.
Right.
They would have had this testimony.
Yes.
Even if they didn't have it in this exact form, they knew from either Matthew, Mark, Luke, or some bearer
right.
of the gospel. They knew this story, and, hey, this is our signal. It's
right.
time for us to get the hell
right.
out of here.
So since this is both a parable and an actual prophecy of both Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and, of course, he's mixing these metaphors between 70 A.D. and the end times just
well,
before the judgment
so.
Day.
Well, I believe so. I believe he is doing that,
yes.
and that's because of the nature of the questions that the apostles asked.
Right.
They didn't know that his return wasn't going to be for several thousand years.
Sure.
Okay? And they're asking him when the city's going to be torn down.
Right.
That was the first question.
Yes.
Because he said, not a stone, you know, the time's coming when not a stone upon a stone shall
yes.
shall remain.
So we can take Jerusalem as a metaphor for the New World Order, okay, that we're living under right now.
Well, I believe that this is Jerusalem. You know, this is the land of unwalled villages in Ezekiel.
Right.
This is the land between two seas of, I think it's Daniel. I'm at a loss.
I think that's Isaiah. I think that's in Isaiah. But yes, yeah, certainly is not the Jew-Israeli state, because that's not a land of unwalled cities.
It's never been.
No. And so the world, the New Jerusalem, we're not quite there yet, but if you substitute the world order we have now for the word Jerusalem here, we're hoping that we know that this final conflict is getting ready to happen, and that there will come a day when we will have to flee from the cities, you know, the cities that where most of us are living in, out to the countryside, just like these Christians did in 70 AD. All right, so... So I'm anticipating that there, you know, once this fighting really gets heavy, that Yahweh will provide a pause in the action, and that will be our sign: get out of the cities now. Okay.
Well, anyways. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in a city now.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, most people who can should leave already. Yeah.
Right. I'm happy as hell. I'm not in a city.
Right. Okay.
Especially in New York City.
Yeah, you're far from there. Verse 22, for these be the days of vengeance, and we're getting, vengeance is mine, saith Yahweh. You know, there's going to be a day of vengeance, the major one, that all things which are written may be fulfilled, okay? And to me, this verse speaks against the idea, it speaks against preterism, because, this is only a partial fulfillment, because they ask, as you mentioned, they also ask in Matthew, what will be the sign of thy coming?
Right, and he's not coming, and he hasn't been back.
He hasn't
been back by 70 AD.
Yeah.
He hasn't fulfilled any of those prophecies.
Right.
The preterists, they use this to try to support preterism.
Right.
But he's talking about all things. You know, the Son of Man came to fulfill all things.
Right.
But then he gave after he died, he gave a whole bunch of prophecy to John. We call it a revelation.
Right.
Well, he couldn't have fulfilled any of that.
That's right.
You know, that when he says something like that, it means all things in reference to what he's talking about.
Right.
It's all things in reference to Jerusalem.
Yes. And they don't get the metaphorical usage of the word Jerusalem. You know, in fact, I think it's in John. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if you would simply have obeyed me. Okay. Of course, he's not talking to the bricks and mortar. He's talking to the people.
Right.
Jerusalem is where the Israel people are. It's not the literal bricks and mortar, okay? And so people have to understand it's being used figuratively as well as literally, depending on the context. And in this case, it's both. Okay, verse 23. But woe to them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. So you can imagine... You know, let's take it back to Jerusalem in 70 A.D. A woman who has a young baby in her arms would be really challenged to flee from the city under those circumstances, right?
Right. It would be very difficult for
her.
Very
difficult, right.
Especially if she were alone. And in a time of war, there's a good chance her husband wouldn't be with her.
That's right.
That the males of war age would be forced to be off fighting. And a lot of good Judah fought against Rome, too, in these Edomite revolts.
Right.
They were Edomite-led, but a lot of our people were caught up in it.
That's right. That's right.
Now, I'd like to talk about this. You know, and if you read one more verse,
okay.
Maybe.
All right. Well, verse 24, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the nations until the times of the nations be fulfilled. Of course, this could have been fulfilled in 70 A.D.
Well, right. And, you know, I translate this heathens, and there's reason for that.
Okay.
But the captivity foretold here and fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, who are the people of Messiah, the prince, in Daniel 9:26.
Right.
You know, and Paul alludes to this in Romans 16:20.
Yes.
And this is recorded fully only by Josephus in his Wars of the Judeans.
Okay.
Even though it's mentioned in many Roman records, it's not recorded like Josephus did.
Yes.
Now, this dispersion of people is not the dispersion of the people of Israel or Judah.
Okay.
That happened 700 years before this.
Right.
This is the dispersion of the non-believers, the bad fig Canaanite Jews, or Judeans, who we call Jews today, and it's foretold by the prophets. This dispersion is
right
in Isaiah 65:15.
Yes.
In Jeremiah 24:8-9, Jeremiah 26:6.
Okay.
Jeremiah 29:17-19. The dispersion of the bad figs is foretold by the prophets.
Right.
These are not the good fig Judahites.
Yes, well, because obviously the ones who are the good Judahites, the Judeans, already fled. They were the ones that got out and went to Pella and other places, okay?
And well, then, absolutely. And yes. And Judah and Israel were dispersed 700 years before this.
Yes.
And the good people here are only a remnant of what Judah and Israel ever were.
Right, right. So the people that were left until the bitter end were, in fact, Edomites, primarily
right.
Edomites.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
And Josephus actually reports, he gives an account of tens of thousands of them being taken slaves.
Uh-huh.
But 1.1 million is the figure he gave of deaths, Judean deaths, in the entire rebellion against Rome.
Right.
And it was a five-year war, and most of that was in Jerusalem.
Right, right. So the city of Jerusalem was indeed very much struck with this, war that the Romans foisted upon it. And the Edomites, the scribes and Pharisees, who we today know as Jews, were the major victims, and also they were taken captive, et cetera, okay? And sure, and surely some of them got away too, okay? Because the Jews themselves talk about they had to set up their yeshivas in Pergamos and Babylon and other places in the Middle East where their so-called head rabbi, I think they call him the Gaon, and then the Exilarch, which is means the exiled rabbi, okay, the leader of the rabbis in exile, okay, that's what they mean by that term. So they set up their religion elsewhere, and there were competing factions among the rabbis in those days. And, the result was the writing down of the Talmud. It took them about 1,000 years to compile all that, all of it being anti-Mosaic, okay? And so we know from this history where they went and how they reestablished their Pharisaic priesthood.
Right, but it's definitely the dispersion of the bad figs.
Yes, yes. So that's
there's no doubt. It's the dispersion of the enemies of God, and that's a matter of the prophets.
Right, right. Okay, a couple more verses. We only have a couple minutes left here. And there shall be signs in the sun, and in the moon, and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations, which we are certainly seeing now.
Well, now that distress of nations, I have an issue with that.
Okay.
Because it's the genitive and not the it's not the accusative.
Okay.
So the accusative can't be the subject of the verb,
okay.
And the distress is caused by the peoples.
Okay.
And I believe that that's referring to the end time distress that we suffer now.
Okay.
The distress by the heathen peoples.
Okay. So in other words, it should say the distress caused by the people.
Yes. Yes. That's what the Greek infers.
Okay. By
and many places in the New Testament, I could point at the same exact grammar where the King James translated it correctly.
Right. Right. Well, I think what we're seeing today, thank goodness, because I know in the state of New York with the swine flu business that the healthcare workers are rejecting this mandatory taking of the swine flu vaccine. And there's a rebellion brewing here. Okay.
Right. And here, well, it's not only that. I think that it's all the heathen peoples in our nation which are causing us distress.
Right.
Because the next line, it talks about the sea and the waves roaring in difficulty.
Right.
And, one of the prophecies in the book of Revelation, after all of his people are preserved,
yes.
There's no more sea.
Right.
What does that mean?
Yes.
Well, the sea, to me, is prophetic of all of the non-Israelite peoples.
Right, right.
Rivers are races of people.
Uh-huh, right.
And the sea is the mass of the people.
Yes.
The beast rose out of the sea. That means that the beast rose out of the mass of the people.
Right, right. Very good. Well, let me just read a couple more here. Men's hearts failing them for fear, and we're going to be seeing that really soon, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. There's going to be a great shaking going on, folks. And they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So a definite reference to himself.
Well, right. And this is, you know, that powers of heaven, you know, that word heaven is Uranos.
Okay.
And a lot of people, and this makes sense to me now, a lot of people think they put this together with uranium,
uh-huh.
which is named for the Greek word Uranos or
right.
heaven.
Right.
Okay. And in Isaiah, it talks about the heat of a cloud
uh-huh.
in a particular end time prophecy. That,
yes.
I'm sorry, I don't have my notes that I rely on.
Yeah.
And it talks about the heat of a cloud. And what kind of cloud gives heat?
Right.
It is only a mushroom cloud.
That's right.
So it's just one scenario. It's one possibility.
Yes, yes. But we will, you know, since we've seen the coming of the mushroom cloud, it's just another indication that the end is very near. Very near the sign of the Son of Man.
Well, right. But I think this also insinuates that there might be a few more of that.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, well, I see there's about 10 or 15 more verses here, about 11 actually. Why don't we save these for next time? And, you know, we will continue with Luke chapter 21.
Well, right, because the next paragraph talks about the fig tree and all the trees, and that's
right.
What we should probably spend a few minutes with.
Yeah, and let me just quote verse 28 then. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near. Okay?
Right, don't be afraid.
Yes.
Be proud.
That's right. That's right. Be proud. Know that this is all happening for your benefit, Israelites, okay? It's the Edomites, it's the Canaanites who are going to be wiped off the face of the earth, not us if we are obeying his law, okay? All right. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening tonight's show. We'll be on again tomorrow night with Yahweh's Covenant People. We'll be in the book of Acts you know, for quite some time on Yahweh's Covenant People. And then Sunday, my guest will be Arthur Jones of the White Nationalists of Illinois. We're going to be talking about the, what's the subject interview? Oh, yeah, how the communists won World War II.
Yes, they did, but the Jews
yes.
are the communists.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And then Bill is going to be on with Brian, Sword Brethren, on his 9 o'clock show talking about Hitler, okay? All right, so
Hitler
those are the
and Christianity,
shows.
Because Adolf Hitler, he was a Christian.
Okay. And so that's going to be the theme for that Sunday night show. And we'll probably have a couple others tweaked in there. And so thanks for joining us again this evening. Yahweh bless, everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.